You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenlon.
The complexity of EU law and its status during the Brexit transition period and beyond continues to puzzle many, if not most, of those tasked with understanding it. The Constitutional and Administrative Law Bar Association recently held a panel event tackling this very topic. The panel included Lord Anderson of Ipswich, better known as David Anderson QC, Professor Catherine Barnard, Professor of European Union Law at Cambridge University, who will be familiar to listeners from our Brexit series, and Alison Pickup, Legal Director at the Public Law Project. This talk is occasionally quite technical, and for this reason, we have provided in the blurb accompanying the episode a link to the PowerPoint slides provided by each speaker, which we hope will make it easier for listeners to follow along. We are enormously grateful to the committee and chair of ALBA, as well as the speakers, for allowing us to reproduce their contributions on this podcast. To begin the talk, we hear from David Anderson QC.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I've got the easy task. I'm giving you a very basic introduction to the subject. Catherine and Alison are then going to develop particularly interesting aspects in more detail. We start with two bills with confusingly similar titles. The European Union Withdrawal Act, in its original form, was enacted before there was any withdrawal agreement. It aimed essentially to provide continuity in the event of a no-deal Brexit. The EU Withdrawal Agreement Act of 2020 gives effect to the withdrawal agreement in domestic law, partly by amending the EU Withdrawal Act and partly by its own self-standing provisions. So to see how the Withdrawal Act is implemented, you have to look both at the Withdrawal Act as amended by the later one, and then you have to look at the freestanding provisions as well of the later Act, though I'm actually going to refer much more to the first of the Acts as amended. Small discursus here into the history of the later Act, the EU Withdrawal Agreement Act. When it was a bill, it was known as the WAB, the Withdrawal Agreement Bill, and there were two versions of the WAB, one from October 2019, one from December 2019. No prizes for guessing what happened in between. So you have really, in the differences between those two versions of the WAB, an object lesson in power and what it means. In order to sell the first WAB to Parliament, where there was no automatic majority, it was thought necessary to give the House of Commons in particular some pretty strong powers, an approval role in relation to the negotiating mandate, a veto over the start of the future relationship negotiation, a veto over an extension. Had the government wished to extend, Parliament would have had a veto over extension to the transition period, and an enhanced parliamentary approval process for any future relationship treaty. There were also, as a sweetener to I can't guess who, additional procedural protections for workers' rights that are currently part of EU law, but which could otherwise have been repealed or modified after the transitional period. But after the election, each of those clauses and protections was simply removed, and inserted were the sections that I've mentioned on the right-hand side. First of all, it was stated in law that there will be no extension. There is a power under Section 26, as it became, of the later Act to direct the courts. We'll come to that later. There was a removal of the legal obligation to seek agreement with the EU on the family reunification of child asylum seekers. All those were the subject of unsuccessful attempts at amendment in the Commons and or the Lords. However, oddly, but gratifyingly, a measure of additional parliamentary scrutiny came in by Section 29 of the later Act, which gives the House of Lords EU Committee a scrutiny function that it didn't have under the first version of the WAB in relation to developments in EU law of vital national interest during the implementation period. That's a scrutiny power that the equivalent Commons Committee already had. It's given to the Lords. Also welcome, for those who think there is value in parliamentary scrutiny of these things, is the perpetuation of Hilary Benn's exiting the EU Committee. The cynically minded assumed that when DEXU was wound up, the departmental committee that shadowed it would be wound up as well. But no, I think it's been renamed, but it's been reconstituted with the same chair. Well, I'm going to try and explain in summary what the status of EU law is going to be, first in the transition period, which we currently assume will expire at the end of this year, and secondly, after the end of the transition period. And this is what, in very brief outline, the withdrawal agreement itself requires for the transition period. Union law, as defined by Article 2 of the withdrawal agreement, applies to the UK during the transition period by Article 127. References can be made to the Court of Justice of the EU during the transitional period. They must be considered by the Court of Justice, Article 86. Supervision and enforcement by EU institutions, agencies and bodies continues during the transition period by Article 131. And the Court of Justice of the European Union continues to have jurisdiction by the same article. And EU law and the withdrawal agreement itself are supreme and have direct effect in the UK as they do in the EU. Article 4. What about at the domestic level? Well, here we're looking at the 2018 Act as amended. The headline, which is no doubt necessary for political reasons, was the repeal of the European Communities Act 1972. That's Section 1 of the EU Withdrawal Act. However, as soon as you get into Section 1A, you find that the Act has in fact been saved for the transition period. EU law, as it was on exit day, 31st of January 2020, applies in the UK, and so does EU-derived domestic legislation as at exit day, though there is reference also to glosses in Section 1B, the 2018 Act, to ensure, for example, that references to the EU operate properly during the transitional period, for example, by using a modified definition of which countries are deemed to be EU member states. That was a vexed issue under the unamended 2018 Act. And there is provision for further glosses to be introduced as necessary. What about after the transition period? Well, here we have to understand the concept of retained EU law. And the basic principle for the post-transition period is to retain EU law as part of our domestic law until we choose to replace it. So if by some mischance we don't get our fisheries bill or our agriculture bill or our environment bill in place by the end of the year, we continue to use legacy EU law as a stopgap, or to the extent that we choose close alignment with EU law, perhaps more than a stopgap. And that is achieved by retaining three categories of rules. The first of those is it's called EU-derived domestic legislation. An example of that would be a regulation or an act of Parliament implementing a directive. The second category is called direct EU legislation, and that means in particular EU regulations and EU decisions applicable to the UK and effective there before exit day. Only the English language version of that direct EU legislation applies by Section 3.4. And then the third category is directly effective rights of the sort that we're used to under Section 2.1 of the European Communities Act 1972. Directly effective rights under the treaties. Examples might be the prohibition on discrimination by nationality, competition rules, the state aid rules, and directives. Although directives are translated into retained EU law only if they are of a kind, or only if the obligations in them are of a kind recognised by the CJEU or by the UK courts before exit day to have direct effect. So I'm not sure what that will mean. I presume it doesn't just mean that there must be a ruling on the specific provision you're looking for, but that kind of provision at least must have direct effect. Then general principles of law are also included by Schedule 1, Paragraph 2 to the 2018 Act, but only if they have been recognised by the CJEU before exit day. There was obviously a sense that this court in Luxembourg was possibly going to start inventing new general principles. They are not to be accepted as part of retained EU law unless they've been recognised already before exit day by the Court of Justice. So what you notice immediately about those three categories is that they don't cover the whole range of EU law. it doesn't cover anything that took effect or that takes effect in the EU only after exit day, after January 2020. It doesn't cover the provisions of treaties or directives that lacked direct effect as of exit day, whatever happened after that. There are specific exclusions for the Charter of Fundamental Rights and for Frankovic damages. And there is also the possibility of repeal or amendment by statutory instrument under Section 8 of the 2018 Act, which we'll come to later. Section 7 sets out how retained EU law can be modified. And to understand this, you have to go to a subgenus of retained EU law. And you find that there are two sorts. There is retained direct principle EU legislation and directly effective rights. Retained direct principle EU legislation seems to be largely intended to be EU regulations, and then put in the same category directly effective rights retained by Section 4. They can be modified only by Act of Parliament or by certain delegated powers, including the ones in the 2018 Act, which, as we shall see, are extensive. If you're looking at that first category, it is also treated as primary legislation for the purposes of the Human Rights Act. So a declaration of incompatibility would remain available against retained direct principle EU legislation, but not annulment or a declaration of invalidity. And then, secondly, there's retained direct minor legislation, which can be modified by other statutory instruments as well. What is the relative force of retained EU law and domestic law? Well, retained EU law is given supremacy over domestic EU law that was passed or made before exit day, before the 31st of January. And pre-exit domestic legislation is subject to the principle of supremacy, even if it is modified after exit day, if, and I'm quoting here from Section 5.3, the application of the principle is consistent with the intention of the modification. I've no idea what that means. I'm hoping Catherine Barnard is going to explain it to us. What about interpretation? Well, references to the CJEU will no longer be available after this year, except in specific areas covered by the withdrawal agreement, for example, citizens' rights. CJEU judgments pre-exit day are binding on our courts, that's the second bullet point, save for the Supreme Court and the High Court of Justiciary in Scotland in criminal matters, which may depart from them, but only on the same conditions as they used to depart from their own prior rulings. And what about CJEU judgments post-exit day? Well, courts may have regard to those, that's the third bullet point, and one imagines probably will, save where retained EU law has been amended or something else has happened that makes it unsafe or difficult to rely on that case law. Then, finally, there is the possibility of the courts being directed pursuant to the delegated power inserted by Section 26 of the 2020 Act, which I alluded to before. I'll come back to briefly at the end. Another slide that isn't here, but I think it raises a question we're all quite interested in. How could you challenge the validity of retained EU law? Well, the answer is in Schedule 1 to the 2018 Act, Paragraph 1. You can only do it if the CJEU has already decided before the end of the transition period, the so-called Implementation Period Completion Day, or IPC Day, implementation period and transition period being synonyms, transition period being possibly a rather more accurate description of the period we're now in. But if the CJEU has decided before the 31st of December this year that an instrument is invalid, then its validity can be recognised, challenged in the English courts. Or if the challenge is provided for in regulations made by a minister, so a minister can specify circumstances in which a challenge is permitted. I'm only aware of regulations made last year to allow sort of transitional regulations to allow challenges to continue that have already been started. But I, looking around the room, I see there are people who will be more up to date than that and might be able to say whether there have been more. Schedule 3, paragraph 1, says that in any event, EU general principles, though they can be relied upon, as I said earlier, as an aid to interpretation, may not be used as a basis for a right of action under domestic law. So you cannot, even if the other conditions are met, rely only on general principles, proportionality, legitimate expectations, and so on, in order to challenge a provision of retained EU law. Although Schedule 8 makes a limited exception for proceedings relating to something that commenced prior to proceedings related to something that occurred prior to exit day. What about implementation of the withdrawal agreement? Well, I can take this very briefly, but the EU Withdrawal Act, as amended, also provides a legislative mechanism for giving effect to the provisions of the withdrawal agreement that are intended to outlast the transition period, notably citizens' rights and the Northern Ireland Protocol. Finally, a slide on delegated powers. I'm only going to outline these very briefly because Alison is going to deal with the crucial subject of delegated powers in a lot more detail. But just to complete my canter over the canvas, if you can canter over a canvas, there is a power, first of all, to deal by regulation with deficiencies arising from withdrawal in Section 8 of the EU Withdrawal Act as amended. There are a very large number of categories of deficiency, and that number has been increased by the 2020 Act. Then there are very extensive delegated powers, again, inserted into the 2018 Act by the 2020 Act, in connection with the implementation period, Section 8A, in connection with separation provisions, those are sort of transitional provisions under the withdrawal agreement, and in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol, Section 8C. I was unkind enough to describe that power in one of our debates as Henry VIII on steroids, because even by the modern standard of Henry VIII clauses, it is pretty remarkably broad. The scope is extremely broad. It only really has to relate to Northern Ireland. There is, in addition, the power to do anything by statutory instrument that could be done by Act of Parliament. There are no exclusions. The usual exclusions for new crimes and taxes and so on are not present. And it can even be used to amend the Parent Act. So very broad-reaching Henry VIII power indeed. Although, in fairness, one must accept that some of these Henry VIII powers, in some respects, are limited by the constraints of the withdrawal agreement itself. Plainly, you couldn't use the powers to do something that wasn't permitted by the withdrawal agreement. And then, finally, I come back to what I described earlier as Section 26. It landed in the 2018 Act as Section 6.5a to d, and this is the power to tell the courts, power vested in ministers, to tell the courts the extent to which they are not, after all, bound by retained EU law. That's part of it. The other part of it is to provide that courts other than the Supreme Court and the High Court of Justiciary may depart in their own discretion from retained EU law. So two different powers effectively wrapped up in one. The House of Lords Constitution Committee said that provision presented substantial constitutional concerns, and even Richard Eakins from the Judicial Power Project described it as rather a mess, though his objections to it weren't quite the same as mine. I think I've had 15 minutes, perhaps even a little more, so I shall make way for Catherine.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's a great honour to be here and also, frankly, completely terrifying, talking about two acts which are incomprehensible and an amendment legislation as well is, Your Honour, hiding to nothing and stand every chance of getting things terribly wrong. So I start with an apology. If I'm wrong, please let me know, but do it gently. But I think all of us are really struggling in this field. We've already heard from David very briefly about the timetable. There are just a couple of points I want to note that you are no doubt familiar with. But of course, once the withdrawal agreement was concluded, it was incorporated into UK law via the 2020 legislation. And of course, that triggered the application of Part 4 of the withdrawal agreement, which is the misleadingly known provision or section on transition, which the government still insists on calling implementation period, although I think this government has stopped using the language of implementation, recognising that nothing is being implemented in this period. Indeed, it is the status quo. But crucially, the withdrawal agreement will carry on applying, and it will carry on applying potentially for decades for a reason that I will explain in a moment. So obviously we're in transition at the moment, will be until 31st of December 2020. There is going to be a crisis moment in June, because in June there is the opportunity for the UK to ask for an extension of the transition period, an extension of 1 or 2 years. At the moment, Boris Johnson's made very clear that he would not do that for love nor money. But nevertheless, there is another point that should be noted, that period, 30th of June 2020, is when there should be an agreement on fisheries and also an agreement on equivalent in financial services. On the latter point, if you've looked at the negotiating mandate, you will see that the UK government, while dismissing most things in the political declaration, is keen on having some agreement on equivalence in financial services by the end of June 2020. If there is no extension, and of course there's all sorts of legal problems if we suddenly decide we need an extension somewhere around about the 24th of December, then the relationship comes to an end, but the withdrawal agreement will stay in force, and it's really quite important, therefore, to get your head around the withdrawal agreement, not to mention the brave new world of some sort of free trade agreement if and when one comes into force. Now, against that background, I've been asked to discuss two issues. The first one is direct effect, and if I've got time, the second one is the charter. And as far as direct effect is concerned, I'm going to say a little bit about what I understand direct effect to be at the moment, and then to look at how it applies during transition, then also under the ongoing provisions of the withdrawal agreement, and then its application post-transition. So just to start with some basics, this might take you back to undergraduate days where you learnt the marvels of direct effect, but in essence, direct effect means that if a provision is clear, precise and unconditional, it will have vertical direct effect, to use the jargon, individual against the state, and it may have horizontal direct effect, individual against individual, individual being the EU jargon for non-state actors. Now, in fact, depending on which branch you go down, there is extensive case law on direct effect. Treaty provisions can have both vertical and horizontal direct effect. In particular, Article 157 on equal pay can have both. Directives, if they've not been correctly implemented, can only have vertical direct effect. But the court has danced around on a head of a pin trying to get round the problems generated by the fact that there is no horizontal direct effect. But it has broadly stuck to its guns that there is no horizontal direct effect. But instead, to try and get round the problem of having no horizontal direct effect of directives, the court has magnificently come up with a new concept, that is that general principles may have horizontal direct effect even if the directive itself does not. Completely mad, because directives are at least written in a legal text that you can read. General principles, you have to go and find some academic tome to try and tell you what they are, and nobody can quite agree on a list of what general principles are in the first place. And then for good measure, the court has also said that provisions of the charter can have horizontal application as well. Now, what's not clear in the incomprehensible decisions, in particular Bauer, whether this is genuine horizontal direct effect or not, or some sort of horizontal disapplication. But in fact, what we're seeing is that direct effect is well established in the case law, and we spend a lot of time trying to explain it to bewildered undergraduates. But most of that will be gone, but not all of it, and I will explain why. So, first of all, take the transition period. I will be brief here because David has already covered that. During transition, we know it's broadly status quo, but when we're talking about status quo, there is a slightly different conduit pipe, and the conduit pipe is now via Section 1A of the EU Withdrawal Act, as amended by the 2020 Act. And if you look at the text of the 2020 amendments, what you see is that while direct effect supremacy is turned off by the 2018 Act, it's turned back on for the transition period via Section 1A. And the reference to the treaties in the Section 2(1) of the European Communities Act 1972 has been extended to include, in particular, Part 4 of the withdrawal agreement. That's the part on transition. So certainly during transition, all of that loveliness that we have just seen still carries on applying. But what about when we come to the end of transition? Let's say, for argument's sake, there is no future trade deal. So we're in pure no trade deal Brexit, but the withdrawal agreement will still be in force. at least I hope it will. And as far as the withdrawal agreement is concerned, you've got the provision in Article 4, which is absolutely crystal clear that direct effect will continue and there will be an obligation on the judicial and other authorities to disapply inconsistent or incompatible domestic provisions. In other words, it's really quite striking. You don't often see language of direct effect in treaties, but for Lowe, it's there right up front in Article 4 of the withdrawal agreement. And so that has had to be incorporated into domestic law. And this is being done by a new conduit pipe. And remember, this is just giving effect to the direct effect and supremacy of the withdrawal agreement in respect of UK law. And that new conduit pipe is now Section 7 of the 2018 Act, and you'll be very familiar with the language that has been largely borrowed from the European Communities Act, so we're very familiar with the terms. Now, I always thought that Brexiteers might be deeply upset by Article 4, but in fact they have swallowed it, possibly because the full effect of Article 4 is buried in rather difficult language in Section 7. But also, of course, the withdrawal agreement, in fact, is rather narrow in scope. It's not as if it's doing lots and lots of things. It is doing essentially the three big ticket things, namely Northern Ireland Protocol, citizens' rights and the money. So it's not as if it's covering the whole gamut of EU law that existed before. But of course, it is important in respect of Northern Ireland and it is in respect of citizens' rights. So I'm going to say something about citizens' rights. So citizens' rights, the provisions on citizens' rights in the withdrawal agreement, that's basically protecting the rights of EU citizens in the UK and UK citizens in the EU, will benefit from principles of direct effect and supremacy. And I think these provisions have got the potential to apply for the next 170 years. Where do I get that from? Because the provisions on citizens' rights will apply to EU nationals in the UK and vice versa, to the last EU citizen born in the UK on, let's say, the 30th of December 2020. And if he's a man and he has a child at 70, then that child will also benefit from the provisions. So 70 plus, whatever life expectancy may be in 70 years' time, that child will also benefit. So 70 plus, 80, 90, pick your figure, EU law will carry on applying. I'm not sure that that's what people originally thought. I might be wrong on that, but I've had no one who has disagreed. So in fact, actually, the rules on direct effect and supremacy, really very important indeed, again, also in respect of Northern Ireland. Now, that brings me to the third stage. What about direct effect in respect of retained EU law? So this will apply in the post-transition period. So this will apply in respect of anything post 31st of December 2020. Now, here it is quite complicated. David explained it much more effectively and clearly than I did. But to put it bluntly, you've got EU-derived domestic legislation. To put it simply, that would be the case of lots of regulations adopted under Section 2.2 powers. So for those of your employment lawyers, think about the working time regulations. They will still stay as good law, even though Section 2.2 of the ECA will have disappeared because they have been preserved as a result of Section 2 of the 2018 Act. You've then got what's called converted legislation, including EU direct legislation, so that's regulations in EU jargon, but also you've got things like directly effective treaty rights. And what you find in Section 4 is a retention of directly effective treaty rights. And if you have a look in Section 4, talking about the treaty rights, what you see is that any rights, powers, liabilities recognised under Section 2.1 continue on or after exit day, and these will continue to be recognised and available. And then Section 5.2 says supremacy will continue. Now, that means that all of those treaty provisions, and potentially all of these treaty provisions, will continue to have direct effect in the UK and will also benefit from the notion of supremacy. However, how does that work? Well, let's take Article 157 on equal pay for men and women. Article 157 will continue to have effect under Section 4.1, and under Section 5.2, it will continue to be supreme over pre-Brexit conflicting domestic law. So a good example would be if there's a conflict between Article 157 and the Equality Act 2010, then Article 157 will prevail, and it can be relied on in national courts in the same way as it can at the moment, and it can be relied on vertically and horizontally against a state and against a private actor. So there does remain a residual constitutional check that many litigators have already taken advantage of. But of course, the main difference now is that if a UK court finds that a provision of the Equality Act 2010 contravenes Article 157, Parliament will be free under Section 7 to reverse that decision or to do whatever Parliament decides. Now, I said to you that there are lots of directly effective treaty provisions listed, but do bear in mind that a lot of them have been or will be turned off. To give you an example, just before the 31st of October 2019, you've got, for example, SI 2019-1401, the Freedom Establishment and Free Movement of Services EU Exit Regulations, and it turns off Article 49 and Article 56. There was no discussion at the time. I totally missed it when it came out. But of course, also the immigration bill will turn off Article 45. So lots of the provisions that you're familiar with will be turned off. But Article 157 does seem to be saved. And of course, then the question is, what happens to something like Article 34 on free movement of goods? No doubt will be turned off, but depending on the outcome of the future trade negotiations. So what I'm saying is, in respect to treaty provisions, there still is the possibility of relying on vertical horizontal direct effect and still using those treaty provisions, if they still exist under domestic law as retained law, they will be able to trump conflicting domestic law. What about directives? Now, this is more confusing. We know that directives which have been implemented into the UK will continue to have effect. They will be preserved as EU-derived legislation. But what happens if there's a conflict between an incorrectly implemented directive and the provision of domestic law? Your classic vertical direct effect case that you would have learnt about as undergraduates. What happens if the UK hasn't implemented a provision of a directive properly? Can it still be used post-Brexit to be used to challenge a piece of domestic legislation? Well, the answer is sort of yes. And you find that in Section 4.2b. It looks like directly effective provisions of directives will be carried across, but only if they have been found to be directly effective and recognised as such by the European Court or any court or tribunal in any case decided before exit day. Now, this is really puzzling, because, of course, by definition, litigation will only challenge things which aren't very clear or certain. You're not going to spend money litigating over things which are absolutely obvious. So the things that have been declared to be directly effective are either the ones that you don't necessarily expect to be directly effective, or they're the ones that serendipity has meant that somebody has litigated on the point. It's just by chance that there's been a case on Article X of Directive Y, not because there is some systematic statement of which provisions of a directive are directly effective. Then it also raises the question, when we're talking about the principles of direct effect being carried across, presumably that means vertical direct effect only. But for those of you who are direct effect nerds and know about the line of case law involving things like Marleasing and the doctrine of consistent interpretation, presumably that's been carried across too, because of the idea underpinning the 2018 Act that there will be continuity between the pre and the post-Brexit case law. Now, as you also saw when we were talking about directives, we also saw how, in the case of an unimplemented or incorrectly implemented directive, there is vertical direct effect, no horizontal direct effect. This creates unfairness, so the Court of Justice has tried to get round it by talking about the horizontal application of general principles instead. And the best known case on that is a case called Mangold, but it also you can see it in Kutryktovich in a number of other cases. So these general principles have been used in horizontal situations, not anymore in the UK. As David's already mentioned, Schedule 1, Paragraph 3 of the 2018 Act turns off that possibility of using a Mangold-style challenge to challenge in a horizontal situation. There's no right of action in domestic law on or after exit day based on a failure to comply with any general principle of EU law. So that route of trying to get some form of horizontality, using some form of general principle to trump domestic law, that has been turned off, as has the rule in Frankovich. Again, for those of you who are direct effect nerds, you might recall that the Court of Justice developed the principles in Frankovich on state liability to cover that horizontal situation where you can't rely on the directive, so you sue the state instead for not implementing the directive. Now, what is very puzzling is that the legislation talks about turning off the rule in Frankovich. Now, if you're a pedant, you might say, actually, the rule in Frankovich doesn't exist anymore because Frankovich itself has largely been replaced by a lengthy line of other case law. And it's very odd that they named a specific case, a case which is largely redundant, to turn off what looks like a rule on state liability. But nevertheless, that's what the statute says, and no doubt any of the judges in this room will be able to enlighten us whether they will take a literal approach to the meaning of turning off the rule in Frankovich, or whether, in fact, what they mean, what they'll understand by that is not only are they turning off Frankovich, but they're turning off the entire corpus of jurisprudence on state liability. Right, so charter. I must say, I've always been a charter sceptic. I'm not a great fan of it as a document. I think it's terribly drafted. But nevertheless, as we saw in Benkebush, it actually does some really quite important, or has done some quite important heavy lifting in terms of giving an effective remedy to individuals that the Human Rights Act does not give. But that has gone. The charter has been turned off. And that's apparently the end of the matter. But this Act does preserve the general principles of law, providing those general principles of law had been recognised by the Court of Justice prior to Brexit Day. Again, these general principles of law, for those of you who have followed this, the general principles of law include fundamental rights. The Court has said that since the mid-1970s. And so general principles include human rights. Therefore, we can still use human rights of sorts via the medium of the general principles, via the medium of Section 5.5. Therefore, the Court's case law on the Charter will continue to be relevant insofar as the Court's case law interprets the Charter, which reflects general principles which the Court has long recognised. So the Charter is gone, but its legacy remains, and that is that we look at the general principles, which I've already referred to, but also, of course, the real importance of the Charter in terms of interpreting provisions of directives which have been implemented in the UK. And, of course, the Court of Justice's case law will form part of retained EU law, and the national courts will be obliged, the UK courts will be obliged to apply it right up to the Supreme Court, subject to the caveats that David has just mentioned about the possibility of departing from pre-existing case law. Final point, yes, the Charter can't be used to challenge any, or the general principles can't be used to challenge the validity of EU law, but there is a little bit of wriggle room. And the wriggle room can be found in Walker and Inuspec. Now, this is a decision of the Supreme Court. It was a case about two men in a civil partnership. They'd been a long-time couple, and the Equality Act in a schedule had said that survivors' benefits could only be paid in those circumstances for couples post-2005. They'd been a couple since 1980, and they stood to lose a huge amount of money if it wasn't backdated until the start of their relationship. And so the question was, did that provision in the schedule to the Equality Act, did that contravene the framework directive, one of the big EU directives? And the Supreme Court took the EU directive, the Directive 2043, took the directive and interpreted the directive against the case law and also against the general principles of EU law. And having remoulded, refashioned the directive, which will continue to apply in the UK, then use that to disapply the exclusion in the schedule to the Act. Post-Brexit, what you can say is, of course, we've got all of that EU-derived law, which will continue to have supremacy, and that EU-derived law, particularly if it's interpreted in a broad way, can still be used to disapply some provisions of Acts of Parliament. So while the Charter is gone, it is not gone for good. Thank you very much indeed.
I think this is a bit more of a straightforward bit of the evening, but we'll see how it goes. So my first slide, I just cited back to the white paper that preceded the EWA, because I think it's really important when digesting and contemplating what we've just heard about the role of retained EU law now, to remember what the policy was behind EWA, the 2018 Act, and when looking at the delegated legislation to also bear that policy in mind. So the policy was to, for purposes of legal certainty and continuity, to essentially do the copy and paste job, and then to make changes just to make sure that that functioned once we were no longer in the EU and therefore no longer automatically had access to EU institutions and so on. The government was very clear from the outset that the delegated powers to then amend EU law were not intended to be used to make policy changes, because changes to our policy post-Brexit should be made after full consideration by Parliament and through primary legislation rather than by ministers acting by delegated legislation. So the basic policy behind EWA is to close the gate through which EU law flows into the UK by repealing the 1972 Act. And I'm going to talk first about EWA unamended, then I'm going to talk about the changes that were made by the 2020 Act. Secondly, to preserve domestic implementing measures, broadly defined EU-derived domestic legislation, and then take a snapshot of other EU law immediately before exit day and incorporate that as retained EU law, as we've heard from David and Catherine. And I've identified there direct EU legislation, the Section 4 EU-derived rights, powers and liabilities, etc., but also principles and decisions made in domestic and CJEU cases before exit day on the interpretation of the retained EU law. Those are also brought into our law as retained EU case law and retained domestic case law. And then also recognising general principles where they have been recognised, as Catherine's just explained. So having taken that snapshot and done the cut and paste job, EWA then gives government the power to tweak, to make it work. That's the intention behind the Section 8(1) power, which is a power to make such provision as the minister considers appropriate to prevent, remedy or mitigate any failure of retained EU law to operate effectively or any other deficiency in retained EU law arising from the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the EU. So again, the white paper, crucially, the power will not be available where the government wishes to make a policy change which is not designed to deal with deficiencies in preserved EU-derived law arising out of our exit from the EU. So what is a deficiency? I had intended to give you all a copy of Section 8 to see, but there's a list in Section 8(2) of deficiencies. So there are things like references to the European Union. They can be amended. But there are also things like ending reciprocal agreements or amending law which depends on our membership of the EU and our ability to participate in EU institutions. Section 8(3A) then adds to that list anything of a similar kind to something that was in that list. And Section 8(3B) gives ministers power to make regulations, adding other kinds of deficiencies to the list if they feel that list isn't long enough. Then Section 8(7) gives explicit restrictions on how other power may be used. So, for example, it can't be used to establish a new public authority, that there are limitations on the kind of criminal offences that can be created using delegated powers. It can't be used to amend or repeal the Human Rights Act. So those explicit restrictions are there on Section 8 power. And then also in buried deep in Schedule 7, paragraph 22, also makes clear that it can be used to restate any retained EU law in a clearer or more accessible way. So this slide, I want to pay tribute to my colleagues, Alexander Sinclair and Joe Tomlinson, who've done extensive research on the statutory instruments made under this power, in particular Alex Sinclair, who's led our statutory instrument filtering and tracking project, and referenced there a blog that they wrote in January, which gives you much more detail about these trends, and I would commend that to you. There have been over 600 Brexit SIs to date. There has been fairly minimal consultation. According to some analysis we did in September, less than 10% have been subject to any form of consultation at all, and only around 9 had a full formal consultation. There have been multiple errors in the SIs. They introduced the concept of the wash-up SI to correct errors made in previous SIs. There are about 65 wash-up SIs at the last count. There have been criticisms of inadequate explanatory material. When you consider what these SIs are doing, the explanatory material is particularly important to enable proper scrutiny of the instruments, because these SIs are amending retained EU law. So they are not amending domestic legislation. They are amending treaty rights. They're amending directives. They are amending general principles. They are amending things that have been interpreted over the last 40 years. And so the explanatory material is particularly important and has been criticised repeatedly by parliamentary committees for being inadequate. There's also been an absence of impact assessments. And also, as Catherine mentioned, the SIs have been used to make significant policy changes. And an example of this is the Freedom of Establishment and Free Movement of Services EU exit regulations, which, as Catherine said, deletes the right to freedom of establishment and the right to equal treatment in freedom of establishment and in freedom of services. This statutory instrument was drawn to the special attention of the House by the Secretary of Legislation Scrutiny Committee, and was the House of Lords voted to regret it, but the House of Commons approved it, and so it became law and will come into force on IP implementation day. Scrutiny of these broad powers is then very important, and the UER established a new sifting mechanism to give additional scrutiny to Section 8 SIs, as well as, I should mention, there's a similar provision for Welsh equivalent SIs and also for SIs making consequential provision under Section 23. So first of all, it laid out some SIs under Section 8 must be affirmative, and others may be subject to negative resolution procedure, but they have to go through the sift first. So what's the sift? Basically, when the government wants to make a negative SI under Section 8, I mentioned Section 9 there, though that's now been repealed in Section 23, it has to lay a draft SI before the House with a memorandum justifying the use of the negative procedure. This is then scrutinised by a new Commons Committee, the European Statutory Instruments Committee, and the Secondary Legislation Scrutiny Committee of the House of Lords within 10 sitting days. Those committees can recommend that the SI be upgraded and be dealt with as an affirmative SI, so have to be approved by a vote in both houses, and the government can decide whether or not to accept that recommendation. If it doesn't, it has to make a statement. So just to give you an idea, since July 2018, nearly 250 Brexit SIs have been laid as proposed negatives, and more than 70 of those were recommended by either the ESIC or the SLSC for upgrade. All upgrade recommendations so far have been accepted by the government. So those regulations then have to go through the affirmative resolution procedure in order to be approved. In scrutinising them, the committees have focused on whether the instruments are either legally or politically important, or whether the changes that they propose are significant enough to warrant further consideration. And ESIC has sought to encourage public engagement through a specially dedicated website in that process, although I question how much public engagement they've actually had, I don't know. To give you one example, and there are more in the blog post that I referred you to, the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies and animal byproducts amendment, etc., EU exit regulations 2018, removed a statutory duty to ensure that staff had appropriate education and training in relation to checks for TSE. This was sifted. If it hadn't been sifted, it would have been passed as a negative resolution. The SLSC recommended it for upgrade because of that omission, That recommendation was accepted and it was relayed as affirmative with that statutory duty reinserted, and the government accepted that that hadn't been intentional to remove that. So the sifting mechanism has played an important role in identifying problems with statutory instruments. Hasn't been perfect, however, and there have been some legal challenges to some of the SIs that have been laid so far under Section 8. So the Plant Protection Products Miscellaneous Amendments EU Exit Regulations removed the blanket ban on hormone-disrupting chemicals in pesticides, and the NGO Chem Trust sent a pre-action protocol letter to the government, and they accepted that that was a mistake and laid a new statutory instrument which reinstated that ban. There was a judicial review brought by Client Earth and Marine Conservation Society of some changes to the Natura 2000 framework in the context of the Habitats Directive. That was refused. Permission, I've summarised the grounds, but essentially on the basis that we'd have to see what changes were actually made under those regulations before considering judicial review. And then finally, the cross-border trade public notices EU exit regulations 2019, which were actually not a Section 8 SI. These were made under the Cross-Border Trade Act. And these would essentially have created a sub-delegated power to legislate by public notice conferred on Treasury officials. And the Public Law Project, where I work, sent a pre-action protocol letter to the Treasury and said, not sure this is what Parliament had in mind when they gave you that power, and they then withdrew that power. It was also made by a made affirmative such instruments that had no parliamentary scrutiny at all. They amended that straight away. So the EU Withdrawal Agreement Act 2020, as you've heard, mainly works by amending the 2018 Act. I started calling the 2018 Act EUA, and we're trying to work out what to call EUA. Tom de la Mer suggested EUAGA. I think that's quite good. I'm going to go with EUAGA. The EUAGA contains 19 delegated powers, many of which are Henry VIII powers. I'm now going to focus on the ones that affect the definition of retained EU law and what is retained EU law. The main changes are that EUAGA made, this is not a delegated power, but instead of requiring SIs to make technical amendments to EU law, Section 1B of EUAGA provides for glosses to derive domestic legislation. So instead of having to have an SI to amend references to the EU, we just have to read references to the EU as if they were EU and the UK, or references to EU citizens are to be read as UK, including UK nationals. It also amends Section 2 to 4 and 6 so that the snapshot is taken immediately before IP completion day, which is the 31st of December this year. And it also makes a blanket amendment of all Brexit SIs that I've been talking about that were going to come into force on exit day, 31st of January. There's been a blanket deferral, so they all now come into force on the 31st of December. There's a set of power to make specific provision for others to come into force on a different date. Then changes made to delegated powers in 20 in EUA after EUAGA. First of all, Section 8 has been amended to increase the scope of the power. So a new kind of deficiency has been added to the list of deficiencies, which you can have in order to exercise the Section 8 power. The Section 8A, which is a new delegated power, allows ministers to modify the glosses on particular pieces, make amendments to the Act in consequence of the repeal of Sections 1A and 1B on IP implementation day, and make such other provisions as the minister considers appropriate to give effect to Part 4, which is the transition part of the withdrawal agreement. Section 8B, power to implement Part 3, and Section 8C, a power to implement the protocol on Ireland and Northern Ireland. And then, as David mentioned, the new power to make regulations empowering lower courts and tribunals, other than the Supreme Court and the High Court of Judiciary, to depart from CJEU case law. Some themes around those, and then I'm done. First of all, many of the powers in EUAGA, including the ones I've just mentioned, which insert new provisions into EUA, refer to our exercise board to make such provision as the minister thinks appropriate. And the government recognised in the delegated powers memorandum that this was a subjective test, and certainly during the passage of EUA, that was quite contested, that it should in fact would be preferable to use the objective test of necessity. But the government's argument in respect of EUAGA was that these powers would be constrained by the withdrawal agreement because they are intended to implement the withdrawal agreement. So they are, to that extent, less broad. These powers are not subject to the sifting mechanisms. That special additional level of scrutiny which I described, which was put into EUA for the Section 8 powers, doesn't apply to Section 8A, Section 8B, Section 8C, or any of the other new powers in EUAGA. However, changes to primary legislation and retained direct principle EU legislation, which, as you all now know, is regulations, require affirmative resolution procedure. Otherwise, they can generally be introduced by negative resolution or after first use. And finally, some of the powers that were in EWA that had sunset clauses, which were so Section 8 was sunsetted 2 years after exit day, is now sunsetted 2 years after IP implementation day.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.